A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast. I'm Georgie Frost here with you on DAB, online and through the Share Radio mobile app every weekday from 9 until 1, sharing ideas about money. Today I'm joined in the studio by editor Simon Lambert, consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce from the award-winning This Is Money to talk through some of the stories on their website they've been investigating over the last 7 days. And on the agenda today, dark web, cyber hacks, identity theft, the stuff of sci-fi movies, no more. How safe are we online in the wake of the TalkTalk hack?
This was not the first time that TalkTalk has suffered this sort of attack. They are responsible for ensuring that customers' information is protected.
Are companies doing enough, though, to protect our data? And how worried should we be about a new bill coming in next week to give police the power to view the web browsing history of everyone in the country? Also today, Lloyds still putting aside millions for PPI mis-selling.
They put another $500 million aside for compensation, brings the total amount to virtually £14 billion. Lloyds were the leader.
It's as new trouble looms on the horizon. Will it ever end? And it comes as Royal Bank of Scotland named the worst bank for branch closures, according to a campaign group. Also in the money charts today, house prices, insurance premiums are on the up, but going down petrol prices and mobile data roaming.
You see it quite often, sad holidaymakers coming back, realising they spent £1,000 by accident because they've downloaded Finding Nemo for their kids and didn't realise it was costing them £10 a minute.
We have all the details and we reveal some of the craziest cars of the future. Plus, who's more excited about the new Bond and Star Wars movie? Us, or the cinema companies hiking their prices? And we're asking today, quite simply, it is Halloween. But do you care? Are you a pumpkin-carving, vampire-loving soul? Or is it all a load of nonsense? A trick to part us with our hard-earned cash? Or a treat for the family? Very good morning, Lee. A very good morning, Simon. Welcome back to the studio.
Good morning.
So I'm going to start with you. A trick or a treat?
I think it's a trick, to be honest. I'm not a big Halloween fan. I think it's an Americanism. I, it's quite nice, that sort of October, autumnal time of year, colder nights drawing in, that kind of thing, makes you reminisce about the sunshine, but I'm not really into that whole gangs of kids wandering around demanding sweets.
What does that say? What lessons does that teach, economically speaking, to go barging up to someone's house demanding things for free? I mean, what are we teaching our kids here?
To beg.
Dressed up as scary
things.
Basically,
to beg for sugar. To beg for sugar. Give me sugar.
It's terrible, isn't it?
Because it works really well when you give them sugar. It does. It turns them into charming little creatures.
Lee, will you be knocking on people's doors?
Yeah, of course I will. No, I used to enjoy it as a kid. It used to be good going around getting your sweets and all that sort of stuff, but these days, girlfriend wants me to dress up this weekend. That's not up for it. You know, you get to a certain age where it's just not for me.
Annie, Weston?
I've embraced Halloween. I think it's probably because as a child, I was a bit neglected. Youngest of five, I had to force my sister to take me out when my mum forced her. And so I had to wear a bin liner. I had to draw some stars on it a bit quick, and I was a witch. And nobody wanted to take me trick-or-treating.
Sad times.
So now, you know, today I'm going to try and get myself a pumpkin, get it carved, to get it in the window.
I was the same as Simon, I have to say. I thought it was a bit American, I'll be honest.
Yeah.
So the only time I've ever dressed up was as Harry Potter, 2007, South Korea, don't ask. However, a friend of mine did ask me to face paint them. And so I thought, I've done a fair bit of portrait painting in my time. However, the pressure was on last night, so I thought I'll get in a bit of practice. Oh, my word, the fun. The bathroom is covered in green, but where's it been all my life? Totally addicted to it. Face painting.
My kids love face painting, actually.
If they need someone, I'm there.
They absolutely love face painting. But I must admit, actually, although I don't like Halloween, I am going to a Halloween party tomorrow.
It all comes out.
A Halloween party. And my kids are going to my mum's.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
A very warm welcome to this Halloween special, Consuming Issues. I'm Georgie Frost. In the studio with me is the team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce here with us to run through the stories they've been looking at this week. And coming up, we talk trouble at Lloyds, RBS under criticism, and talking of trouble, bubble housing trouble in London. But first, let's talk about TalkTalk. quite some week for the broadband provider after another cyber hack there.
This was not the first time that TalkTalk has suffered this sort of attack. They're not the bad guys, but they are responsible for ensuring that customers' information is protected.
Well, that was public relations expert Kevin Craig there. Now, this was a biggie, but TalkTalk says that while its website was compromised, its core systems were not. No account passwords were taken, apparently, and credit and debit card numbers were protected. But they did admit bank details and personal information of UK customers could have been accessed. Who by? Well, that's now in the hands of the police. Here's Joe Faith, editor of yourmoney.com.
The numbers are incredibly worrying, that about 4 million people could potentially be affected. The company's chief exec has come out and said that their cybersecurity is, quote, head and shoulders better than its competitors. But she's warned that, you know, this could happen again, that the telecom sector is open and other sectors to other cyber attacks, and that it is a worrying part of working and being on the internet.
Well, it's worrying. After suffering days of concern, worrying if your card details were in the hands of criminals, customers now face months checking credit scores and bank accounts just to make sure their cash, even their identity, hasn't been stolen. So who could blame them if they wanted to switch? Well, TalkTalk could. You want to leave, says the company? Then you'll have to cough up to £275 in termination fees. That's unless you've actually had money stolen. And then, generously, they will waiver those fees. Investors, it appears, rather like that news, taking a look at the share price. And yet, millions could legally quit without penalty and may be entitled to damages, according to your investigation. So you've been looking into this for us. Firstly, a very warm welcome, Simon. Let's start with you. What is the latest with TalkTalk? What have they been saying?
Well, TalkTalk told their customers that they couldn't leave, basically. So understandably, if you were a TalkTalk customer and you felt that your details had been stolen and you feared that you were going to be defrauded in some way, then you might decide that enough is enough and you were going to call TalkTalk up and say, look, I'm off. Doing one, I'm going somewhere else. And they were told that they would have to pay themselves out of their contract or wait until it ended. Now, our colleagues on Moneymail spoke to a consumer expert, he's a lawyer as well, founder of the campaigning consumer action group, Mark Gander. And he said that actually it's possible that TalkTalk are in breach of contract here because they failed to protect people's personal details, which you would expect them to protect your personal data. So actually you can say to them, well, you're in breach of contract and I'm leaving, and I will not pay you these fees.
This is really interesting. They've actually spoken to a few lawyers on this, but Mark Gander particularly says, there is a fundamental principle here. How important is the protection of the personal data to a consumer contract? You would be able to argue that it's critical, and that anyone who had not acted sufficiently to protect a customer's data was in breach of a contract and so made it void. That TalkTalk had already been susceptible to two hacking attacks before this third one is proof enough, I think, that they have not taken enough steps to protect their customers' personal data. Three in 12 months, Lee, is not good enough.
It's not good enough, and I could totally understand if you're a TalkTalk customer that you'd want to leave. I mean, it makes perfect sense that you'd want to leave. But at the same time, if TalkTalk started letting everyone leave, you know, the company would be in crisis. You know, so you have to look at it at both sides of the coin. But if I was a TalkTalk customer, I'd want to leave. And actually, in that story, we actually highlighted Section 18 of its terms and conditions. And it says, we take protecting your data seriously and will do our utmost to employ appropriate organisational and technical security measures to protect you against unauthorised disclosure or processing. So they're clearly in breach of that section of the contract. And we've got a template on our website where you can send a letter or email to TalkTalk to try and get out of your contract. And we've received dozens of emails of people that have tried to cancel and are getting quoted absolutely crazy cancellation fees.
I was going to say, I bet you your readers are pretty unhappy about that announcement. If nothing else, it's a terrible PR move, isn't it?
It's so difficult to handle one of those types of things when it happens, a crisis like that. It really snowballs. And you know, I can imagine the customer services were completely snowed under and it was difficult to get through and all that kind of stuff. And actually, the details took quite a while to emerge. The people were panicking that their credit card details had been taken and all that sort of stuff. And it was really, like, the chief executive, Dido Harding, was really struggling to answer questions of what was happening, and that was quite a worry.
Problem is, this is a criminal investigation still ongoing, and let's be honest, the details are coming out quite slowly. Who were reasonably happy, particularly after that announcement about not being able to leave without termination fees? Investors taking a look at the share prices recently.
Yes, they were. But actually, I was just going to go back to that bit about Dido Harding, because she actually said after this happened that TalkTalk hadn't done enough. She said, obviously, I'm paraphrasing here. She was quoted as saying that TalkTalk obviously hadn't been doing enough to protect this data. So actually, it would appear that you'd have a pretty good case for arguing that they hadn't done it. And yes, investors, obviously deeply concerned that TalkTalk shares were going to take a prolonged hit.
They got a pummeling,
From this. And that pummeling was going to stay. It's not about just a temporary pummeling. It's about whether it's just going to keep going down. And obviously investors decided that, yeah, that this was quite good news, that they weren't going to let people leave. But I think actually there's a wider issue surrounding the contracts on things like phone and broadband and TV and mobile phones at the moment, where I think this scenario where people are being pushed into longer and longer contracts, you know, we're talking like 24-month contracts for these things. And then if you do need to leave for any reason, say, and that could even be for the reason of perhaps moving home or something like that, then they will charge you an absolute fortune to get out of this. And I think that these contracts are just inherently unfair. Mm-hmm. And I understand whereby, say, for example, with a fixed rate mortgage, if you lend someone money on a fixed rate mortgage at a low rate over 5 years, then the trade-off for taking that low rate fixed for 5 years is you're not going to leave. You agree to those early repayment charges. But I don't think that these TV, phone and broadband deals or mobile phone deals are cheap enough to justify the penalties that are put on people for leaving them early. And I think the entire system is unfair.
Well, it's interesting. Rachel Rickard-Strauss wrote an article about TalkTalk investors don't believe will ever switch broadband provider. Prove them wrong. She wasn't going on so much about that, but more about how much companies are protecting our data. And I'm assuming investors rather like the news that you would have to pay a termination fee because they think by the time our contracts come to the end, let's be honest, most of us won't be bothered to move. And they have a point. 30% of UK broadband customers have never switched. This is according to a YouSwitch study. 44% have no idea when our contracts end. And unlike our energy firms, broadband providers don't have to let us know either. So she's saying, send them a message.
Yes. And she said it would be a terrible message to send to a company if basically it was allowed to have a data breach like this and people didn't fight back and didn't leave. I mean, the one thing I would say about these termination fees, of course, is that actually maybe investors are cheered because if you think about it logically, a large termination fee is great for a company because it basically gets the money that it would get for the rest of the contract without actually having to bother providing the service.
Absolutely. Now, this all comes, as we're being told, tens of thousands of us are having our personal details stolen and our identities traded on the so-called dark web. All sounds rather nasty, doesn't it? Indeed, more than 600,000 customer details were reportedly stolen from companies in the UK in the last year. And how much are you worth, do you reckon? Well, according to this, less than 20 quid. Lee, this is rather scary stuff. Firstly, and don't go into too much detail, I'm not expecting a really in-depth analysis of it, but what is the dark web,
briefly? Simply, it's, if you think of it as like almost like a background internet that we don't see, it's more sort of like hackers contacting each other, gleaning information, trading information. So, you know, for example, this TalkTalk hack, some of that information may now be on the dark web and being sold to fraudsters to use for certain purposes, including, you know, telephone scams that have been doing the rounds massively in the last year. It's been a big boom in that, and that is where they trade details. You've got your contact details on there, you've got your bank account details, enough information to phone someone and convince them that, you know, they're calling from your bank or calling from a company legitimately, and then raid your bank account.
Goodness me. So you can only actually reach the dark web using specialist software. It's not everyone can get access to it, but the people that can will know how to do it. But how seriously should we take reports like this, do you think?
I think Lee? Massively. It's going to become a bigger and bigger problem as the years go on. You know, more people going online. You know, a lot of people are wise to scams and wise to things that are going on. But, you know, there's a generation of people that are maybe not so wise to scams. And I think it's just going to be a growing problem, and there's loads of money to be made from it. I mean, you know, these cyber scams are worth hundreds of millions, and they're just going to go up and up and up. And I think there were some crime statistics out a couple of weeks ago for the first time that included fraud, and it was actually frightening what proportion of it was fraud, and a lot of it is online.
Simon, are companies doing enough to protect our data?
Possibly not. I mean, to look at it from the company point of view, companies do take this very, very, very seriously indeed. You will see these breaches. I don't think you'll ever see an end to these breaches because, you know, you can always exploit a loophole and you can hack into a system. You know, look at scenarios where you hear stories about people hacking into, you know, sort of state defence systems and things like that. So if they can get in there, then chances are they might be able to get into a shop or a service provider that you do business with. I think maybe we're a bit too free and easy with our data, to be perfectly honest. I mean, when was the last time that you bought something online from a new shop that you'd never bought anything from before and you actually stopped and thought, is this genuine? Am I actually handing over my bank details to this company that is a genuine company? Because quite often we will buy things from shops that we've never heard of, that we don't know anything about, and you give them, in order to purchase something, you give them your name, you give them your address, you give them your bank card details, and you give them the 3-digit code on the back. I mean, that theoretically is enough to spend quite a lot of money on someone's account. So, I don't know, maybe it's probably going to change somewhere. There's going to be some extra level of encryption. We're going to have to start being a bit less free and easy with our data. But there is that element where we're used to using services for free on the internet, and in return for using services for free on the internet, we'll give them a little bit of information. Mm. We'll give them our email and our password. And then we will also quite happily buy things or trust people in a way that maybe we wouldn't trust them in real life.
We're told to change our passwords, but if companies like TalkTalk are getting hacked into, what chance do we have against that might that Lee was talking about? And I'm wondering as well, there's a bill that's coming in next week, new surveillance bill, force telecommunications companies to keep information on all users' activity for 12 months. The government want to do it. Is this a good idea?
I guess probably the defence that you have, and I'm sure that some expert could shoot my suggestion down here in flames, technology expert, is possibly some form of, like, you know, protection in numbers. The sheer volume of people and traffic and the sheer volume of this information going out on the internet means that it's quite unlikely that you are going to get picked on. And what you need to do, therefore, to stop yourself being picked on is protect yourself in every way that you can, i.e. in terms of, like, keep an eye on your bank account, look out for anything suspicious, be a bit careful about who you give your information to, and if someone does phone you up saying they're from your bank and asking you to move money to a safe account or things like that, just be aware of those scams. And actually, probably those preventative measures could probably protect a lot more people than maybe some of the stuff we worry about in terms of online security.
Indeed. Well, let's stick with mobile broadband providers and some cheerier news, shall we? For those of us travelling in the EU from June 2017, we'll no longer have to face extra charges to use our mobile phones. It's after Euro MPs formally approved proposals to scrap roaming charges. So in 2 years' time, we'll be able to make calls, send texts and go online wherever and not face paying through the nose. Here's retail expert Vic Slayton from Quidco.
This has been a popular personal finance gripe for quite a long time. You see it quite often. Sad holidaymakers coming back, realising they've spent £1,000 by accident because they've downloaded Finding Nemo for their kids and didn't realise it was costing them £10 a minute. So it's a lot. I've got a mixed view on this. Whenever I've read these stories, and like, it's going to sound quite harsh, I always think, people, it's been like this for a long time. How many times are you going to be able to plead ignorance? They expect businesses to pay for their mistakes. And I nearly did it myself. I went to Budapest, and Budapest was not in the European area that Three covers for your feel at home, because Three have been really good. And on the whole, like in Sri Lanka, I've paid the same as I would have paid at home. But Hungary was not one of the countries listed. And I'd set an iTunes album's downloads weeks before, so it was pre-ordered, and I didn't realise. I switched it on to check my emails and it started to download, and I thought, I'm going to have a hell of a bill when I get back. Do you know what? I wouldn't have gone back to Three and gone, do you know what? I forgot that I pre-ordered an album. It's now your fault. It's good for the people that have made mistakes. It's going to ensure that people aren't stuck with a bill that they don't want to pay. But it feels a bit nannying to me that we've had to do this.
Well, that was retail expert Vic Slayton. Well, Lee, tell us a little more. What have they had to do? What's coming in? What's changing?
So, you know, you read those stories when people come back from, especially Europe, when you think, well, Europe's not far away from Britain, you know, we're part of Europe, and people come back with these absolutely extortionate bills for downloading, you know, various things, putting photographs on Facebook, for instance. It's going to be a thing that doesn't happen anymore. So there's going to be a blanket price for roaming, for sending text messages and for phone calls. It's going to make it a lot cheaper for people that are in Europe. So if you are a businessman, for example, you probably won't need to get a specialist package to go and get, you know, charged okay when you're in Europe. Now, the one thing I will say with this is that experts are saying that the charges are going to get passed on somewhere. So you're going to get charged somewhere. You know, it makes a lot of money for providers. So probably what you're going to see now, I'm going to suggest in the next 2 or 3 years, is more expensive mobile bills overall, just you know, for a general mobile contract to negate the cost.
Why specifically were they introduced? How many people are affected by this?
Well, it's going to be thousands of people that, you know, go away every year. It's expensive to use your phone abroad. And, you know, we see these all the time. You know, it's £5,000 for downloading, you know, I don't know, a little TV programme. Accidentally, your kid might have done it, you know, while you're away. And that should stop that. It should stop that from happening. And I think it's just been done because, you know, we're part of Europe and they're trying to sort of make everything a blanket. And mobiles are one of those things.
Well, taking a look at some of these figures, they call it bill shock from holidaying in the EU. It affects more than 9 million UK mobile users a year, according to research from YouSwitch. Around a fifth of mobile customers have returned home from an EU trip in the past year to find their bill was higher than usual, amounting to £573 million collectively. Simon, you've got a little story about this.
Yeah, I do. So, basically, my mobile provider, which is Virgin Mobile, every time before I went away to Europe, what they do is they offer you the opportunity to buy a package. You have to buy a package of data. And they do this because they're saying they're protecting you against, you know, getting hit by unexpected roaming charges. But obviously, the cost of roaming, data roaming in the EU has been falling steadily now to the point where it's now a maximum of 20 cents per megabyte. And so I'm happy to just say to them, I just want to be able to use the internet in Europe. I don't want to buy one of your packages. I just want to be able to use it because there's a cap on it. And I've phoned them up each time I've gone to Europe and said, please, could you make sure that my phone works in Europe, the data? And they say yes. And you eventually get through to someone in a call centre somewhere and they do it. They say yes. And then it never works. So when I went away in summer, I phoned up again. And I spent ages on the phone trying to sort it out. And it turns out that actually I got given the truth this time rather than just a yes, we've turned it on and then it didn't work, which was no, you can't do that. The only way that you can use, I was told by someone from Virgin Mobile, the only way that I could use my phone abroad, the internet on my phone abroad, was to buy one of their packages. Now, this is despite the fact that their packages aren't really that much cheaper, actually, once you compare them to the cap. And also, they have an end date on them. So sneakily, you buy the package when you're on holiday, say, for example, in June or July time, and then you don't quite use it all up, and then it runs out. And so you don't get to use it by the time you then go away in 4 months' time. I think that there's a nice little bit of money that they're making here on this. And the whole point of this, of the roaming thing to do with the EU, is to do with the EU freedom of movement. It's the idea that we are in a common market and that is meant to be good for consumers and it's meant to be good for businesses. And so, say, for example, you were travelling to France on business, you shouldn't have to be taking out some special data plan or being charged through the nose for checking your emails on your phone. You should just be able to do it without being ripped off. And so that's why the EU are doing this, and also to protect consumers. But I think that what Virgin does is absolutely outrageous. And I complained to them, and they just went, "Puh, that's how it works."
Editor Simon Lambert, Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
Now let's have an update on Lloyds, shall we? I'm going to focus on you, Lee, because we've spoken about this in the past. Last time you were in, we were chatting about the target culture, the bad target culture in the banks looking to be returning in their branches. Firstly, any update on that?
There was actually an update on that. Yeah, the Daily Mail actually did a big expose on it, and there was this new operation, this thing that they called Operation Labrador, I think it's called. It does seem that there's growing evidence that they are putting more sales targets back into branches, and that seems to be the case.
After they tried to cut them out,
exactly.
Only in January, wasn't
only in
it?
In January, yeah. Goodness, but sales of products in branches fallen off a cliff. So.
And now, your latest article that I have here, she can't drive, rarely travels and owns a £10 phone. Lloyds charges 80-year-old Mavis £1,000 for an account with perks she could never use. Now, this focuses on Mavis. She's one of 9 million people sold a packaged bank account in the past decade by the banks. Just to give you an idea as to how unsuitable this particular deal was for Mavis, she was paying almost £13 a month. AA breakdown cover was included. Fantastic. However, she hasn't actually been behind the wheel of a car since she failed her test in 1962. Last week, the Financial Ombudsman Service revealed that it had received almost 30,000 inquiries between April and September into packaged bank accounts, almost as many as the whole of last year. So, Lee, firstly, tell us a little bit more about this, because when you give the details, most people would be forgiven for reading about Mavis and thinking this is an absolute clear-cut mis-selling as you could get, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I would totally agree with that viewpoint. So, Mavis in 2007, would have gone into a branch. She was just sort of signed up to a £12.95 a month current account with the perks that you've mentioned. So car insurance, she doesn't have a car. Travel insurance, she very rarely goes away. You know, mobile phone insurance, she's got a cheap mobile phone. She doesn't need it. And unfortunately, in years gone by, that sort of thing has been rife because inside the branches of Lloyds and other banks, it's not just Lloyds that have done this in the past, you know, they would have been given more points, the branch staff, to put on a packaged current account because it makes the bank more money.
Lee, I do have to ask you, for anyone not familiar with packaged bank accounts, I mean, I've sort of intimated what they are there, but is it essentially that? You get a bank account with loads of added extras?
You get loads of added extras, yeah, and a lot of the time people can't take
advantage. Can you pick and choose, or is it sort of like a...
Some used to let you, it's sort of toned down a little bit more now, but I remember Barclays used to do a bolt-on account, so you used to be able to pick if you wanted travel insurance, car insurance, bolting on, but with Lloyds, it's just all clubbed in together.
I want to ask, what are the rules around selling financial products?
Well, you know, with current accounts back then, it didn't seem that there was any rules, because otherwise people like Mavis wouldn't have been...
Well, they temporarily stopped selling packaged bank accounts in branches in 2013.
That's right. So that was an exclusive that This Is Money had, actually, where we found out from staff members that they had a big meeting and were told they were no longer allowed to sell these current accounts in branch because, well, I was told because of mis-selling, but of course Lloyds wouldn't, you know, confirm that to me. But the FCA... you know, massively looked into that market, and I think a lot of it's been toned down as a result of that investigation by the FCA.
Now, when Mavis did complain to Lloyds about this,
she did, and their response is just one of those like great bank responses. She said, "Well, she came into the branch and she said she was going on holiday, so she wanted travel insurance." I mean, I'm really sorry, but you know, I don't know where Mavis had gone on holiday that year, but it's very, very unlikely that she wouldn't have been able to get a better value insurance product elsewhere. And unfortunately, she's just either signed up for this account and forgotten that she signed up and it's got a monthly fee, or she probably just wasn't, you know, told and hasn't been checking her statements. And, you know, 8 years on, she's got these, racked up these charges.
Now, I've heard some people call this sort of the next PPI. And in August, you mentioned their Money Mail's investigation revealing that Britain's biggest banks had set aside £825 million to cover claims for missold packaged accounts. Lloyds put aside £175 million. They're not the only ones, as you pointed out. RBS, £400 million. Barclays, £250 million. OK, it's not the billions that we've seen with PPI yet, maybe. But, Simon, could this be just the tip of the iceberg?
I don't think it'll be as much as PPI, to be honest. The relentless mis-selling of PPI was something quite spectacular by banks and credit card companies. But I think there's a lot of people out there with unsuitable bank accounts. There's this brilliant bit in this story that says the bank threw out the complaint, saying it was not possible for its staff to, and I quote here, explain all the policy exclusions and eventualities for the insurance products. So I would say that that's true. I don't think that the bank staff should be expected to read out all of the small print. But if they can't read out the small print, maybe the small print's too long. But they maybe might want to look at someone like Mavis and go, this is completely unsuitable.
Exactly.
And then there's this bit at the end where it says, a Lloyds Bank spokesman says that when Mavis opened the account, it was recorded that she wanted travel insurance. We're aware of Mrs. Taylor's case, which is with the Financial Ombudsman, and as a result, we are unable to comment at this time, he added. Now, I know exactly how this will have happened, the when Mavis opened the account, it was recorded that she wanted travel insurance. There will have been a question like, do you ever go on holiday? Yes. Use travel insurance? Yes. Tick. Miss sell package account. Yeah. Basically. Allegedly miss sell package account. Sorry.
Thank you very much, Sam.
I think there are a lot of people who've got this, and we talked about this a few weeks ago. A friend of mine has been miss sold a package bank account. We were having a conversation the other day. And he said something about this. What's this package bank account stuff I hear about? And I said, well, it's for people who are paying for bank accounts they don't need. He said, oh, I pay for my bank account. I said, why are you paying for your bank account? He said, well, they told me I had to. I was just like, do you want to pay for your bank account? No. Do you use any of the stuff with it? No, they just told me I had to. So there you go. Another person missold a package bank account.
Well, thousands, apparently. Thousands of inquiries between April and September. Talking of mis-selling, we're going to focus a little bit on PPI, because Lloyds have also been talking about that as well, urging regulators to bring forward the deadline on PPI complaints, as its compensation bill for the scandal soared to just under £14 billion. Now, the state-backed lender announced a disappointing set of results affected by the slowdown in the UK economy over the summer and revealed it had set aside another even more amount of money for PPI mis-selling. The bill, says Brian Tora of investment management firm JM Finn, who spoke to us earlier, has been enormous.
They put another £500 million aside for compensation for the payment protection insurance. That brings the total amount to virtually £14 billion, which is the most of all of the banks. I mean, Lloyds were the leader in this area, but it is staggering how much the banks have had to pay out in respect of this particular mis-selling operation.
So it does go on, but a time limit to be put on complaints. Not everyone happy about that. Martin Lewis, founder of Money Saving Expert, claimed the time bar is being introduced to protect Lloyds and make it easier for the government to sell shares in the bank. Simon, your thoughts on that?
I think Martin Lewis is wrong. I think Martin Lewis has done very well at campaigning against PPI. I think This Is Money's done very well at campaigning against PPI. But I think that we basically have to draw a line under this. I don't think that there's many people in the country who can be unaware of the PPI situation. And how much longer are we going to allow this to rumble on for? And yes, you can say it does Lloyds a favour and it does the banking industry a favour. And it does do Lloyds a favour and the banking industry a favour. But the PPI bandwagon has been rolling on for many, many years now. Claims companies have built up a whole cottage industry out the back of it. It continues to hamper our banks. And by hampering our banks, it's limiting what they can do in terms of actually lending to businesses, lending to small businesses. It's making them more risk averse. And I do think that they should bring in a time limit on it, and it's time to draw a line underneath it. I think that in Lloyds' case, it probably wishes the time limit was last Tuesday, you know, and I can totally understand it. But I think that if the banks want a time limit to be brought in, then what they have to do is they have to agree to start dealing with PPI complaints properly. There's too many people being turned down for PPI complaints.
When you say properly?
OK, there's too many people who basically initially write to the bank using, for example, a free letter, a free template like we provide or like Money Saving Expert provide and many others provide. And then the bank writes back to them and says, no, we didn't missell your PPI. And then if you were that person and you walked away at that point, you wouldn't get any compensation. But if you were that person and then complained to the ombudsman or you wrote again to them, then you get compensated. And we've heard many, many occasions where this has happened, where banks have basically turned down people who appear to have cast iron PPI claims first time round, only for the complaint to continue, and then they end up getting paid out thousands of pounds. So the banks need to pull their socks up, and that's what they need to do in return for this time limit, is basically make a proper promise to start dealing with this properly and then get it finished, set a date, and then it's done.
Do you know what I'm looking forward to with the terms of this time limit? It's hopefully no more phone calls on my phone telling me to claim my PPI, although they'll probably tell me to claim a packaged account instead. One last thing on the banks before we leave it. Lee, Royal Bank of Scotland is the worst for branch closures. This is according to a campaign group. One in three closures between 2014 and 2015 was at the hands of RBS or sister brand NatWest. This is according to the Move Your Money group, which pushes for banking reforms, also accusing RBS of going against a promise to safeguard branches, which are the last in town. Lee, you write about this. Tell us more.
So, yeah, there was data out today which showed that RBS and NatWest have got rid of a serious amount of bank branches in the last 2 years. But the main point of this is that more than half of last bank in town branches that have been shut since 2014, so they're communities that are only served by one little bank that's in their market square or wherever it may be, has been from RBS or NatWest. But in 2010, they ran a television advert campaign which says, we will never close a last bank in town. It's only taken them 4 years and they've started chopping them at a faster rate than anywhere else. So I kind of understand it. You know, it's fewer people using using branches now. And as they rightly point out, you know, a lot of people are using mobile banking and using online services. And branches are expensive to run and maintain. But there's a lot of businesses in these little rural areas that, you know, rely on going into the bank, using the cash point and doing other various services there.
Also, Lee, I got contacted by my bank, this is Lloyds here, who upped my credit card limit by £2,000. I didn't ask them to. So I called them up and said, I don't want that. And they said, I'm afraid we can't do it online. You'd have to go in branch. By the way, Miss Frost, we've also sent you a letter that's been returned. I said, can I give you an updated address? Yes. You have to go into branch to do that.
And that's exactly it. And actually, you know, this exactly the same thing's happened to me and it's happened to my girlfriend. Both had our credit limits absolutely jacked through the roof. And
it's
I'm
awful.
Almost like, wow, you know, I don't need this cash. And I contacted and they said I had to go into branch. And I just haven't done it because, you know, all these branches are closing. And actually, I read a story yesterday. There were some credit figures out. and that there's more people taking out credit cards and personal loans, fastest rate since 2006. It doesn't help when your own bank and your own credit card that you already have are putting up your credit limit without asking.
Absolutely. You're talking here. Spendthrift Britons, this is according to the Metro today, are plunging into debt faster than they have for almost a decade, according to the Bank of England. Borrowers owed £176.3 billion by the start of September. That's up 8.2% in a year. You're listening to Consuming Issues here on Share Radio.
So you want to learn to make the most of your money? Of course you do. But you want to learn while also listening to satirical songs and sketches? Of course you do. And that's why we invented Managing My Money. Let me move your rates up and
down. Huge debt.
Managing My Money is an official Open University course. You can take the test and earn yourself an Open University certificate to show how financially savvy you've become. So join Annie Weston and me, Glenn Goodman, every Monday at 9 p.m. And if you miss an episode, go to the Share Radio website to find out when it's repeated, or just download a podcast instead. It's never been easier to fill that hole in your nozone layer.
Do go online for more information about that. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio on digital in London, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. I'm here every weekday between 9 and 1. Editor Simon Lambert, Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce from This Is Money are with me in the studio. Now, have you managed to see the new Bond movie? Perhaps you're feeling a little bit smug. You saw it before your friends. Looking forward to the next Star Wars movie in a couple of months. Well, not as much as the cinema companies, who are making the most of our excitement with the so-called blockbuster tax. Odeon's added an extra £1 to tickets for the first few weeks of release of Spectre and the Star Wars movie. The cinema giant says prices vary depending on the type of entertainment and location, it would seem, because a This Is Money investigation has unearthed the huge difference between ticket prices at Odeon cinemas across the UK. Good news if you're a family of four in Hull. You'll pay £20 versus £52.40 in Richmond. So I believe, Lee, you've been looking at this. Yeah. Tell us more about the blockbuster tax. Cheeky.
I think it's really cheeky, this, actually. And basically what it is, Odeon are just sticking a quid extra on their tickets for James Bond Spectre, which has just come out, and Star Wars The Force Awakens, which comes out in December. And it just means it just puts up the price of cinema even more. But of course, these films are in high demand. It's for the first 4 weeks that they come out. Star Wars, for example, the ticket sales of that are absolutely crazy, and people are getting very excited about it. But I think it's a really, really quite sneaky move by Odeon.
How long do they keep it on?
About 4 weeks,
yeah. You say. Simon, your views? It's expensive anyway, though.
Supply and demand. Get with it. We live in a capitalist society. Come on, stop moaning, people. Get out there. Spend some money. Stick the tickets on your credit card. Get the economy moving. Honestly. Gone out and made a movie for you and everything. Mm-hmm. I do think it's very cheeky, isn't it? I think the cost of going to the cinema is very cheeky, full stop, actually. I know that, I mean, I don't get to go to the cinema very often, and we didn't used to go to the cinema that much anyway, but every time I do go to the cinema, I am absolutely astonished at the cost of going there. Yet people still flock there, and if you think about where we are now compared to where we were maybe 10, 15 years ago, when there was this real concern that the cinema industry was dying out and it was in all kinds of trouble, it's amazing, the turnaround, and I guess it's become that sort of spending on an event kind of thing, experience thing. It's like, I'm always astonished that people pay for the posh seats in the cinema, you know, the big luxury seats.
Well, it's basically, and you just pay for the normal one and move, don't you?
Don't do it right at the start, because they check after the start. Just wait about 10 minutes after the film started and then do it. But do you know what? Guess which mug paid for those posh seats last time we went to the cinema? Yep, I did. And they were comfier, and I did think, you know, that's all right. But I tell you what, talk about investments. A really great investment would have been shares, Cineworld shares. Those have done really, really, really well in recent years. So if you'd have looked at this and gone, there's a trend emerging there, I'm going to tap into that trend, that company's going to do well, then you would have made a good spot.
On your website, you've got a poll. I do love your polls. Would you pay blockbuster tax to see Spectre or Star Wars The Force Awakens? Pretty comprehensive, this. Yes, 14%. No, 86%. Simon?
With the Star Wars thing, right, the thing I don't get is, I love Star Wars, and I've loved Star Wars since I was a little boy. But that means I've waited quite a long time for this Star Wars movie to come out. So I'm not really that bothered if I have to wait an extra couple of weeks to see it. But I guarantee that possibly I'm in a minority for a certain demographic. Yeah, but certainly our readers have looked at this and just gone,
Then everyone will ruin it for you by telling you the plot. That's what they're going for, isn't it, these cinemas? Tell your friends so they can pay extra money and come to
the cinema.
You could
probably guess at the plot anyway, couldn't you?
Is there much of a plot? It's probably just dancing around. And
anyway, let's move on from this and let's talk about, very briefly, shall we, talk about housing as well. We're going to be talking about the latest house price figures show they've jumped another 7,500 in a year. Average home will now pass the 200,000 mark. Meanwhile, home buyers increasingly choosing to fix their mortgages amid uncertainty over the timing of an interest rate rise. That's according to Nationwide. As we're seeing on the front cover of City AM, bubble, bubble, housing trouble. Economists warning that London's property boom could be coming to a shuddering halt.
One of the things I think that's really driving prices is the lack of available stock. So agents right across the country, I think this was reinforced by the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors recently, reporting that typically agent stock levels are at levels probably not seen anywhere any time since the last 10 years. You know, encouraging willing buyers out there. Borrowing costs generally have never really been lower. Average fixed rates in the marketplace are pretty much on the floor.
Well, that was Brian Murphy, head of lending at the Mortgage Advice Bureau. So, Simon, your thoughts on this?
Well, I guess logic would suggest that basically house prices are very high at the moment. So how much higher could they go? Because essentially they are kind of unaffordable and high by most sort of long-term measures. There is this element where you can actually see this bit on a chart where you start to see the point where basically everyone accepted they needed two earners in order to buy a house. And so maybe those long-term comparisons aren't fair. But there was also something put out by the ONS yesterday, which is the National Population Projections 2014-based statistical bulletin. Exciting sounding thing. But it says that the UK population is projected to increase by 9.7 million over the next 25 years, from an estimated 64.6 million in mid-2014 to 74.3 million in mid-2039. Wow. And it will reach 70 million by 2027. And all those people will need to live somewhere. And there has been the suggestion that this is going to add an awful lot more pressure to particularly London and the South East, because that is the bit of the country where everybody wants to live, which is what drives up prices so much. So it's difficult to know exactly what's going to happen here. I think that we are possibly seeing a trend where people are looking at London and going, it's too expensive, and they're deciding to go move to Manchester, to Leeds, to Birmingham. Maybe if you leave the market to itself, it will sort of slightly correct itself. But there's another interesting thing in here, actually, which I'll just mention. It's totally unrelated to housing, really. But it's to do with the way the demographics of the population change. Yeah. And this is actually quite a worrying thing for those of us, I guess, in what you could term that squeezed middle generation. The people who basically don't have not seen the same benefit from house price rises in terms of their personal wealth, although actually I would argue that's not a good thing, but seeing very, very expensive properties and struggling to get on the housing ladder, is basically we're going to have to be supporting a lot more old people who are pensioners whilst the working age population is not going to go up very much at all, but there are going to be lots more children. So basically this generation in the middle are going to be the ones having those children, paying for those children, whilst also having to pay to support this massive growth of people in pension age. And what that probably spells is higher taxes.
We have been hearing today young people facing the worst economic prospects for a generation. This is according to a report from the Equality and Human Rights Commission. It says under 34s have suffered the biggest drop in income since 2008, now face greater barriers to achieving economic independence and success than they did 5 years ago. And also it comes as research released today from Your Move and Reed's Range shows that a record number of aspiring homeowners believe that buying a property is now out of reach. Just quickly, your views on that, Lee, is possibly the youngest person here in the whole building, but
it's obviously out of reach for a lot of people because house prices in the last year or two have just absolutely rocketed, you know, and it is difficult to get that deposit together and get on the ladder. And actually, me personally, at the moment, I'm in the midst of trying to buy a house. It's not just getting the deposit together, it's actually finding a place where you think is good value. And at the moment, it's really difficult. There's a shortage of homes going up for sale, and the ones that are going up for sale, I think, are up for ridiculous prices. So, you know, it's a tough old market out there still at the moment.
Now I'm going to turn our attention to something we've covered with you guys in the past. Good to touch on it again as big changes kick in this Sunday. I'm talking here insurance premium tax. Sticking with the announcements made in the summer budget, millions of motorists, homeowners and pet owners face an increase of 6% to 9.5% to their insurance costs. So families with two cars, a pet and medical cover will see bills go up around about £100. That's according to the Association of British Insurers. Rachel Springall from moneyfacts.co.uk says it's worth thinking ahead to prepare for the price hikes.
Anyone who's got an insurance policy right now needs to think of what next year that may bring. So it's wise to kind of put in a £3 to £5 a month extra rise of any potential bills in future. I mean, that's what I personally do. Even if your circumstances haven't changed on your insurance, you should really allow an extra premium, because typically you'll be charged more as each year goes on. You've got to think about things like inflation. You've got to think about things that may increase. And as you get older as well, insurance becomes more expensive. So anyone really with any insurance policy needs to think about paying more next year, regardless of any changes.
So tell us a little bit more. What's IPT? What's coming in? Why the changes?
It's a tax that the government charges insurers on your insurance, so car insurance, travel insurance, those types of things. The reason it's going up, I think it's just a nice little earner for the Treasury, really. I mean, there was some estimates put out by KPMG, the tax specialist, says that IPT generates about £3 billion a year for the government, and that these increases will raise an additional £1.75 billion. Mm. Now, insurers are going to be charged more on this tax. So it's going up from, I think, 6% to 9.5%. So it means on a £500 annual policy, instead of insurers being charged £30 tax, it's going to cost £47.50, and the insurers aren't going to suck up that cost. That is going to go straight to consumers.
Now, U-Switch does say that you may be able to put off the immediate cost impact for a while longer. I mean, it comes in when? Sunday, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you've not got long.
Not long.
It's a small window now. Yeah. A couple of weeks ago, that wouldn't have been bad advice. But now, yeah, not really.
Simon?
Well, this is going to be one of those things where people just get their insurance documents and they just like sort of scroll through them and go, why am I paying that? But I tell you what is a sneaky insurance fee. I've got a limited mileage car insurance policy on my car, basically, because it's a classic car. And it's 3,000 miles a year. And I was going to go over the 3,000 miles. Not by very much, but it runs until December. So I called up my insurer and I said to them I needed to raise it. And they said the next level up is £5,000. So I said, OK, well, I'm going to have to take the £5,000. No, 5,000 miles, sorry. Mm-hmm. Never going to get to 5,000 miles. Because it runs out in December, but it's fine, I'll take it. She went off and calculated the cost, extra £50. And she said, but there is a £25 administration fee for changing the policy. I said, hang on a minute, are you charging me £25 for paying you £50? And she said, yes. And I asked if they would waive it, and they said they couldn't waive it under the treating customers fairly rules, because if they waived it for me, they'd have to waive it for everyone else. And I said, that's not how treating customers fairly works. Don't ask me why I know, but I'm telling you, that's not how it works. And she said, we're under strict instructions not to waive the fee, so I have to write a letter of complaint. But I just thought that is so sneaky, and that happens all the time with these insurers, mm-hmm. charging you £25 to like change a minuscule detail on the policy that basically involves someone answering a phone and pressing a button.
It does indeed. Well, let's stick with cars, but some good news for drivers. Average UK petrol price, Lee, at its lowest for 5 years, as Asda lopped 2 pennies off a litre of unleaded at its 273 petrol stations. So it means that drivers will pay no more than 103.7 pence a litre for unleaded, meaning prices at that supermarket are now 5p a litre cheaper than the UK average, 7p less than the oil giant BP. Lee, how much does this have to do with the supermarket price war?
It's a lot to do with it, and I tell you, Asda really have led the way in the last couple of years when it comes to fuel prices. AA earlier in the week put out some data which showed, you know, it is cheaper than Morrison's, Sainsbury's and Tesco by quite a distance, and then much cheaper than the big players sort of like BP and Esso and those types of guys. But, you know, going into an Asda petrol station does make you more likely to then use its supermarket or use its store, which is no bad thing. I mean, it seems to be one of the cheaper supermarkets anyway. But those that aren't in an Asda area are the ones that really miss out, to be quite frank with you, because Asda has low petrol prices, so competitors in the area have to sort of, you know, put their prices accordingly to sort of, you know, make sure it's not too much more expensive than Asda.
Lee, give us an idea of how much prices have fallen, because I remember back in the day, and I've not driven properly for a long time, about 5 years ago, was it not about 130p.
Absolutely raced ahead a couple of years ago. Yeah, I mean, oil prices went through the roof there. Oil prices were sort of $120 a barrel at one point. You know, really expensive. At present, they're $48 a barrel, which shows you just quite how far oil prices have fallen. And what's happened is now that a large proportion of the petrol price that you pay is just going directly to the government in terms of fuel duty. And as the price comes down further and further, the more that tax looks high, because it's not at a percentage, it's an actual figure of 58p a litre. So that's a big old chunk.
Which you then pay VAT on, by the way, well, I should add. You pay VAT on your fuel duty.
So there's been calls, there's this fuel duty freeze that's happened in the last couple of years from George Osborne, and Asda are just saying, you know, please don't put it up next month in the budget, which you could be tempted to do at the moment because prices are falling quite dramatically.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering as well, and we'll be talking about crazy cars in a few short moments, but with oil prices going down, it's cheaper at the pump. What news for electrics? Are people less likely to look for greener alternatives?
No,
how are they doing?
No, at all. Electric cars have really, really grown in the last 6 months. And if you go onto the This Is Money website, you can see Boris Johnson driving a Mitsubishi Outlander PHEV, which is the biggest selling electric car by some way. He's driving it in Tokyo, and I think he described it as sounding like a demented cat, but in a nice way.
He said, it whines like a self-satisfied cat.
Self-satisfied cat.
And then we move swiftly on to, from the sublime to the ridiculous, the Tokyo Motor Show has always been the platform for car makers to reveal perhaps the crazy end of the concept vehicle spectrum, should we say, and 2015 event has not disappointed. You've listed the top 10 craziest vehicles here. I have to say, I rather like some. One where you can stand up, good for the person with the bad back, particularly like the car that can park itself on command from a smartphone or tablet. That's got my vote. Yeah. So Lee, as the car expert, your top picks.
Well, first of all, I'm going to say with the Tokyo Motor Show, most of these cars will never be made. They tend to be real sort of crazy concept stuff. Some of this technology that you're talking about probably will become quite mainstream. I reckon self-parking cars could become a thing. People hate parking cars in tight spaces. If I had to pick one, I don't know if I'd pick any of them. They all sort of like look like boxy, weird, strange things from a dystopian future, if I'm being quite honest with you.
Saying that, the Nissan IDS, which can park itself, I thought, it looks all right.
Yeah, that's probably, I reckon you've picked the best of the bunch there.
That's not the Nissan Ian Duncan Smith, by the way, just to confirm. my favourite is the Suzuki Airtriser.
Okay.
It's powered by a 1.4-litre hybrid engine, mounted in the wooden floor panel of four independent seats and a rear bench. When parked up, the four seats can be moved independently to face each other, what Suzuki calls relaxation mode, or set up in a U-shaped sofa arrangement called lounge mode. A mode that I would imagine, if ever introduced, which unfortunately this car will not probably ever be produced, would be extremely popular with teenagers who like to treat their cars like a house and some other things in a house.
OK, I'll accept that that's your favourite, but it does say, according to Rob Hull, who wrote this article, the best feature of said car that you want there, the sliding doors split in the middle with one shifting forwards, the other section moving back, a bit like getting into an elevator. If that's the best thing you've got to say about a car, it feels like getting into an elevator. I'm not sure I'm sold.
Maybe they're copying the Rolls-Royce New Dawn, which I remember when we spoke about. You don't get out of a Rolls-Royce Dawn, you disembark. Like someone getting out of a motor launch on an Italian lake, I think Rolls-Royce said.
You should have written that, Simon. Thank you very much, Simon and Lee from This Is Money. Share Radio.